Hello and welcome to The Week of Work. I'm your host this week, David Gibney. But this is going to be a special episode, a pre-record episode, and it was recorded at Skullcosh Clee on the beautiful island of Inishere at the start of September. Just some background, Skullcosh Clee is a festival which is organised by Left Bloc, which this podcast, The Week at Work, is a part of. We organise a festival once a year, and this year we had 150 activists from all across the political spectrum in Ireland and in Britain and elsewhere. It included trade unionists, political party activists, some artists, and then some people with no affiliation whatsoever. The idea of the event is political education with a large focus on climate collapse, but also some of the big issues of the day. In this episode, we listened to an inspirational talk by long-time activist, socialist and feminist Bernadette McGalliskey about nationalism and the far right. We want to keep these podcasts and the political events going, and we want to grow and expand. We can only do that with your help. So you can support us if you like the work that we do, or you want to get involved, or want to attend some of our future political economy education sessions. You can support us by going to patreon.com/leftblock, or go to our website, leftblock.ie. So without further ado, here is Bernadette McGalliskey talking about nationalism and the far right.
Janny Shen Gormila Maigav Artus Tesulagam Gerwin Shiv Elig and Mage Sult and Mage Olas and Mage Edgechus Afurme Hian as Jeremy Shacht in the Shaw. Either Kyol, Agus Crack, Joch Agus BMI, Vishakahinta Agus Wakas Dahandina, a wee Bunchilakoran and Jero Shacht in the Hela. So, first of all, I hope everybody has enjoyed the weekend as much as I have, has learnt as much from debates, crack, kyol, the lot. It's been a fantastic weekend for me. I came last year for the first, and the degree of energy and information that we create here collectively across a broad section of activists and academics, and I don't differentiate between those. Just not all academics in the world are activists, and not all activists are academics. But between debates and data sets, we go away energized. It's very difficult to go to a meeting of data sets and go away energized, but we managed. We always managed to pull that off. And so when it comes, a bit like Sean said in the last session, when it comes to this time of the day, it's hard not to be repeating what everybody else has said all the time. But you'll notice I don't have PowerPoint, and there'll not be a data out of me till I've been And that's not to say that I'm not one of Gramsci's intellectuals, and I'm not an academic or not an activist. It's just not my thing. I do data sets and I do those for my work, so I'm not going to come here at the weekend and have to do them here. What I do want to talk about is the far right, and the far right in the context of nationalism. Because I think that on this island we get confused. And nobody gets more confused, in my view, than the left about the difference between the ideology of nationalism and the fundamental necessity of national sovereignty. And nobody gets that, nobody but the left gets that as confused. And partly it's because of the tension around, especially in the context of colonialism and imperialism, the context of national liberation movements, and then the moving towards the creation of and development of national sovereignty. And because I think the reason people get it wrong is, one, the political tension within that, the alliances that are made. You know, as Connolly said, everybody would betray us in the movement to national sovereignty except the working class. And he was right. But that's not to say that national sovereignty can be achieved solely by the working class from a position of weakness. And it never has been. And so the issues around how we build towards national sovereignty are one thing, because it's not actually simply what we do, but how we do it that determines the outcome of anything. You know, the methodology we adopt in doing something affects the outcome as much as the actions that are undertaken. It determines in some way where we end up. And because in the history of this country, we've always ended up in not a very good place. After the last national, when I say national, I mean All Ireland movement for independence and for national sovereignty, we ended up with partition. We ended up with a carnival of reaction, as Connolly put it, on both sides of the border. And we come to the point today where we effectively end up in two failed or failing states. I think if you think of the South as a failed state, it's not entirely there. You have to wait till you get as far as we have. And we're still in the North, about two steps in front of you down that road. And surprising how well we're doing at the minute. We don't actually, and this is, you know, it's how far you can go without a government. We don't have a government. You know, we never have a government. We have an executive acting on behalf of the government because the government is in London. And people are sometimes deluded by Stormont that Stormont is a government. It's not. The national government still remains in London. And the government coalition, power-sharing government in the north, functions within the parameters of the legislation in London. It can't make any legislation that is in contradiction of the existing legislation in the Westminster Parliament. So we don't have them now. We haven't had them since I was never interested in them. I forget how long we've been without them from time to time. But we haven't had them since the last election. And the reason we don't have a government there is that Sinn Féin won, became the biggest party. Now, when the Good Friday Agreement was created, as creative ambiguity and signed up to, let me state at the outset, I voted against it. It was a bad agreement. It was an ambiguous agreement. It was a dishonest agreement. And it deliberately lied to the people whom it saw as furthest from the table in order to get them to the table and then tried to buy them off with European funding, American investment, and allowing a period of adjustment for paramilitaries for a period of time where they were allowed to continue by the use of arms to make up for the fact that they didn't have any money because they spent most of the time on the run or in jail or fighting for one side or another, and corrupted people by allowing them a period of time to continue fundraising by robbing banks and things so that they would have some fallback, some opportunity to buy small laundries and flower shops and pubs and train as bouncers and take over communities within and under the guidance of the state. But what was very, very clear, and what some of us argued at the time, was since everybody had been lied to, or that's how I looked at it, the what was said, it wasn't a new trick, let's put it that way. The same thing was done at the time of the First World War, when people went from small nations to fight for imperialists because they believed that it would lead to the freedom of small nations. And when empire loyalists in exactly the same countries went and joined the same armies to fight in the same war for the same empires in the belief that the empire would protect them from national liberation movements. And so with the Good Friday Agreement, the argument to each side's national identity, to each side's, I'm going to say each side, I mean the broad Republican nationalist axis on the one side and the British Union loyalist axis on the other. And each side was convinced by separate private talks that their national sovereignty agenda was being furthered and protected by the Good Friday Agreement, and that they would come together in joint government and all would be well, and money would be thrown at them and the place would settle. Now, many of us argued at that time that there would come a time, there would have to come a time when these two conflicting ideologies would meet in the same space, because they were now going to be running the place. And at some point, the mutual exclusivity would be laid bare. And that was when Sinn Féin became the biggest party. Because no unionist, and let's be clear about it, no unionist, and I'm not saying no Protestant, I'm not saying no individual within the unionist tradition, no unionist party was created or has an ideology that can countenance playing second fiddle to a Fenian. Simple as that. The Good Friday Agreement was always going to be in trouble if the balance of power in the North shifted from unionist domination in terms of a head count to nationalist domination in terms of a head count. Now, in the intervening period, I don't know what people thought would happen. But what did not happen was that in that period of peace, as they called it, it wasn't peace. It was the absence of widespread politically motivated violence. It was the absence of armed struggle. It was the absence of maintaining the state by the imposition of controlled by the British Army. So it was the removal of arms from the equation, which is not exactly the same thing as peace in any sustainable way. And the period in the 25 years was essentially squandered by the representative politicians sitting in Stormont. If there had been any serious plan, then to stabilise and bring justice to the North, there would have been a 25-year plan at the start for desegregating housing, for desegregating education and schools, for desegregating the apparatus of government, and there would have been a complete overhaul of the democratic boundaries around elections that would have dealt with the historic infrastructure of the state. Because the historic infrastructure of the state was created to ensure that a minority within the state that constituted 30% of the population, that's a big minority, could never by peaceful means acquire social, economic or political power. And that's what the infrastructure of the state was about. So the mechanics of the state were to keep Fenians in their place. And of necessity, the state therefore had a policy and what we now call strap lines. Not an inch, and what we have, we hold. That was the national motto of the Northern State. Not an inch, and what we have, we hold.
And no surrender.
Well, if you're not parting with nothing, and you're not sharing nothing, no surrender is kind of a given. So, only really comes into play when it looks like you might be asked to give half an inch. And the policy then comes in, no surrender of half an inch. So when you see that, you begin to see how people, how that question gets posed, because if the question had been posed that the movement for social justice in the North, after the militarization of that situation by the state, and not many people in the South get their heads around this, but whatever the IRA in the North did, they did not start the military action in the North. That didn't happen. The use of political violence, the use of force, and the use of arms came originally from the Northern state, not even the Northern Loyalist paramilitaries. It came from the Northern Ireland Police Force. And when the state could not be held by the Northern Ireland Police Force, the British Army arrived. Not to save, I mean, in the process, they did temporarily save the nationalist Catholic population from a hiding, from a kicking, from a slaughtering match. But that was not why they came. They came because the state could not be maintained at that time other than by the army. That's what armies are for. Internally, they are to uphold the status quo when the peaceful mechanism, socially, economically, and politically, failed to do so. So just remember that you have an army in the South. Just remember, you have an army in the South. You heard Claire Daly. You heard where the generals of your army are, sitting over, getting to understand their place in the world. So when we're talking about rebuilding a national sovereignty on this island, don't forget, you have an army in the South, and it's not yours. Maybe your neighbours, your sons, your daughters, that your brothers, your sisters that are in it, but no function of the Irish Army is to look after the people in this room. Its function is to look after the state. And the state in the South is not the same as the Irish nation. So I have bad news for all of you. We don't intend joining you. We don't intend joining you. We don't intend being subsumed out of the frying pan and into the feckin' fire. So, what the Loyalists and Protestant people of the North don't understand at the minute is that we, and when I say we say those who have struggled and fought for human rights, social justice, workers' rights, on an anti-imperialist, socialist, and feminist basis. We will be harder to deal with than the DUP. We will be harder to deal with than the DUP. Because if you think we spent two generations and traumatized two more yet to come by what we've been through, to live in this God-forsaken state, you have another thing coming. We have paid the price for better, and better we will have. And so when we talk about national sovereignty and a new Ireland, it's back to basics. Your constitution isn't fit for the new purpose. And it's not for the state to draw up a new constitution. That's not how constitutions get driven, get started. And to deal with that, I'm going to go back and talk about two men, because I think people shouldn't forget about them. Neither of them were Marxists. And they have to be forgiven for that, because Marx wasn't born at the time. So, he would have had maybe a good impact on one of them. Had he post-dated Marx, he might have done better. But the other one, no, he wouldn't. There was no saving him. And they go back to a discussion and a debate that I think everybody should be familiar with and should familiarise themselves with. And that is the big debate that was held when we were all under the thumb of London between Thomas Paine and Edmund Burke. And if you look to the north, the Republican movement in the north historically takes its origins from the ideologies of Thomas Paine. So unfortunately does Donald Trump and other people. But because Paine was talking about the right of the citizen to determine the control of the state. Not that the individual is supreme, but it was in the context of monarchy. So with due respect to me, there'd be no queens here, me nor nobody else. It was a respect of monarchy. And it was a critique of monarchy. And the beginning, I mean, Thomas Paine had to flee the country. I always have sympathy with him because there were a couple of other gays and they actually were not charged with sedition, which was a hanging offence. But Paine was charged with sedition for writing pamphlets like The Rights of Man. And in the court, the judge was asked basically why Paine. I asked that question myself after the riots in 69, the defence of the Bogside. There was hundreds fighting. Nobody could charge, only me. I just kept looking to say, why me? I have no idea to that, but Thomas Paine got an answer in the court. And it was that Thomas Paine wrote pamphlets and people who could read them to workers and peasants. The other guys were writing pamphlets and he said, the poor and the working class don't understand them, so they're not sedition. But Paine was writing and speaking in the language of people and taking what he was writing into farms and factories and industrial sites and arguing that monarchs had no divine right to rule. That no country should be ruled other than by the consent of its citizens. And that everybody's first responsibility was to themselves, their second responsibility to society. And he began to define society. And he set out how to protect society, was that the people themselves have to determine their own constitution. And what they have to look at and who they are protecting themselves from when they write a constitution is themselves. So the question each of us have to ask is how much of my own individual liberty I will put in the general pot in order to protect myself and everybody else from my own weaknesses. Not protect me from you or you or you, but to protect me and everybody else from my own frailties like greed, ambition or whatever. And that was the basis of the beginning of bourgeois revolutions. The right of the ordinary, plain people, the rights of man, unfortunately. And in the context, the weaknesses of Paine were that he was writing of this kind of sovereignty issue, that national sovereignty did not reside in an individual, it resided in the collective of the citizenry, and define who were the citizens of a country, and what the boundaries of a country and state were, and then society then set up within the constitution, and you can see that in the Irish constitution. The constitution sets out the principles by which we agreed, except we didn't agree them. De Valera wrote them in the back of an envelope, and everybody said, that'll do, Dave, and got stuck there. comely maidens dancing round crossroads, my arse. You know, even as he wrote, let me tell you, there were enough women in Ireland to have said, cut that out there, cut that out. No comely maidens round crossroads here. Or when he determined that the primary place of women was in the home. Do you think the women of the Citizens' Army, do you think common man, do you think the women who fought for basic rights in the factories at that time said, dead on, Dave, that's just what we were looking for. Back to the fucking kitchen. No, he didn't. No, he didn't. But when the Constitution was written, it was at least understanding that it was moving from monarchy, from the rule. Now, the British talk a lot about constitutions. They don't have one. They don't have one. You know, if you said, show me the Constitution. Oh, well, there was the Magna Carta one time. One time. There was about three kings in England when they were writing that. So actually, you know, King Charles, as he is now, he is the state. He is the representative of the state. You know, when Michael D. Higgins, and we are blessed to have Michael D. Higgins as the president, let me tell you, but when he meets the head of state, his equivalent, he's elected by the people. When he meets the head of the state of the United Kingdom, he doesn't meet Boris Johnson or Rishi Sunak. Them's lower rank. They meet Leo and Martin. The president of Ireland meets the head of state, top notch, which is a monarchy. The monarchy runs the United Kingdom. And the Parliament exercises authority by the grace of God and consent of the King. Now, the British are very lucky that they have not yet had a full-scale lunatic run the country. They kind of hive off the insecure before they get that length. But there is nothing to prevent. I keep hoping that at some time, you know, because he is interested in the environment, that he's going to give Parliament a run for its money. It is going to start, you know, refusing to sign laws. But being serious about it, that what's not understood, I think, in the South, is once the national, from the partition side, you're better off than us. We were still stuck. We were still stuck in the South. But the opportunity to begin in the South to put the democratic program into effect never happened. And it never happened, precisely as you say. The people who were running the country, the Free Staters, we still call them blue shirts and Free Staters. That's just colloquially in the North. I think they're called Fine Gael down here. those people took out anything that was progressive and began to build, and we heard Connor speak of that very clearly over the weekend, began to ensure that basically the state that was being built in the South was not a threat to, but was based on and a modern extension of the interests of British and Irish capital here. So when people thought they had national sovereignty, and the point I think is again well made when we talk about the equation when we're coming forward about where we stand with the European Union. Because all of us in the left and in the Republican left campaigned against joining it. But it's a bit like telling, you know, it's a bit like telling young women, for whatever else you do, don't marry that man. But they don't listen. Then about 5 years later, they come back and they tell you, how the hell do I get out of this marriage? They're harder to get out of than they are to get into. All of them. Getting out of any of it is messy. So imagine multiplying that into the European Union. But that question has to be raised, because the position of an Ireland as we see it, as we would talk about building it from the bottom up. The conversations about the Constitution have to be had in every town and village and factory and union across the country, so that we know before we go to a referendum what it is we're voting for and what it is we're voting against. It can't be, would you like Ireland to be united? Yes or no? Oh, yes, it would be grand. But bear in mind that the people who are asking that question already clearly have a nation in mind. It's only us that haven't the questions answered. It's not that if we don't do that, if we don't begin a constitutional conversation based on upholding the fundamental rights enshrined by the United Nations, based on workers' rights, on community rights, on land rights, on nature rights. If we don't write those into the Constitution now, it won't mean that we won't have a Constitution for the New Ireland. It will mean that Micheál and Leo and Larry Goodman and Christ knows who else on up the ladder will pull the one they have in their back pocket out on the table. And if we have that, then our mechanics are wrong from the beginning. When we're in a process, and I think we're in a remarkable moment of history, where for a very small island, the opportunity to begin to open that discussion on, because the prospect of a border poll is now on the table, to open that discussion as to what kind of alternative Ireland can we create and put to the people is crucially important, because it's the only debate and discussion that will challenge nationalism that we're up to our knees in at the minute, and to a right-wing nationalism that people call the far right. And I think Connor used Father Ted, "This island's terrible," but I use it in the same way myself. Why do we call them the far right? Unlike the small cow, they're not even far away. They're right here. They're right here in our streets, in our factories, in our unions. Now, there are two types of people when we conflate two groups of people when we talk about the far right, and we shouldn't. We need to call the ideological right by its proper name, and I'll come to that in a minute, and separate that out from the vulnerable proletariat. Black Panthers used to use the word, I love the phrase, lumpin' proletariat. Ireland's full of them. At a minute, the lumpin' proletariat. The people who are suffering the responsibilities and the impact of capitalism, but do not understand why they are suffering, why they are poor. They have no idea why they are poor, except that somebody else is less poor than them. And so it must be their fault. Because that's as far as they can see, somebody who has something that they don't. We also have to face that neither right-wing thinking, the ideological right, is not a new phenomenon in Ireland. It didn't get imported from the far right in England, although they strengthen it. It was here all the time. It was here when Bishop Duffy blessed those going to fight for fascism in Spain. It was here then. And it was mainstream, for the bishops were recruiting to send Irish men to defend fascism in Spain in the 1930s. Tommy Robinson wasn't even born at that time. Nor is racism a new phenomenon in Ireland. It didn't come with increased immigration. It didn't come with people fleeing from Somalia or Eritrea or Libya that made the difference in how people in Ireland view those fleeing war from the global south and those fleeing war from Ukraine. What's the difference? Colour of people's skin. Nothing else. Nothing else explains Ireland of the Cade Mhilá Fáilte for Ukrainians who rightly should not be asked to sleep in tents. But exactly the people who are welcoming people from the north and quite rightly fighting for better housing and better support for those people. Many of them are exactly the same people who, as we heard over the weekend, are kicking the shopping bags out of the hands of people living in contingency accommodation in direct provision. What explains that? And what explains for the rest of us our racialized thinking? What explains in all of the prejudices that we have or don't have in this nation? And we've seen as immigrants, new immigrants come in, you know, it's always been the bit, you know, as the next wave comes in, the previous wave at least looks like good immigrants. But there's one group of people who, no matter who comes into this country, moves further down the bottom. And that's the traveller population. And that's not as a result of the far right. That's left, right, and centre. Left, right, and centre. What is it about the traveller population that leaves them that way? A fear of nomadism? Prejudice? Racism? So how, if we haven't dealt with those, are we going to look at a new Ireland without raising them? I come on then to say the biggest challenge that we have in doing that will not come not only from the state, but will come from the people we call the far right. Because they are active in nationalism. I heard it in the north. After the signing of the peace agreement, I went to, and a number of reprobates, when we couldn't move forward, we moved sideways. That's always a good idea. Rather than retreat, just move sideways, and they mightn't notice you. Just step aside and work over here for a bit. So I was working in an organization called STEP, and I worked there for 25 years. And part of our work was because we were doing community organizing, and so once we had a growing immigrant population, we were working with the traveler population, we're working with the new immigrant population, and working with local communities and estates, single moms, and just the way we were organizing. But people would come in where I'd be working. Need to see burned it. Always need to see burned it. You could tell by their face what they needed to see burned it about. You used to be on our side, and now you're on the side of the foreigners. You used to be on our side, and now you're on the side of the foreigners. All the things people would say was, don't think that we fought hard to win the small bits we have got for people to come in here from Portugal or East Timor or wherever it would be, Lithuania, Poland, and get the benefit of it. They should go back to their and stay in their own country. And that wasn't the far right. These were people who thought Burnet was the bee's knees, till Burnet started to say, "Now that we've got a bit of elbow room here, let's share it." Because the ideology in some of the people just weren't getting any benefit out of the piece, you know, taking my job. I used to say all the time, right, show me your job. And if I can find somebody that took your job unfairly, I'll get it back for you. Nobody took anybody's job. People say, no, you're just twisting what I'm saying now. You're just twisting what I'm saying. But that's where the work is, you know. And we heard that over the weekend. If you're not where the people live, if you're not talking to the people, you can't defeat the ideology of the far right, because they are. They are. And the name for the ideological far right, as I say, they're not far at all, the fascist. And the timeline of fascism and the pulling the thread of fascism is that fascism is closely aligned with nationalism, not national sovereignty, not national identity, not popular sovereignty, not democracy. Fascism, we speak of it as a dirty word. Who called it fascism first? Do you know who invented the word? Mussolini. Mussolini called his own ideology fascist. Fascists are as proud of fascism as we are of Marxism. It's not some deficit that people fall into. It's an ideological belief. It's endemic. It's endemic in white Western civilization. Because we unconsciously believe God made the world and he made it white. And apart from the Irish, who are in a very vague position, everybody else in the world thinks God also made speaking the national language, power language in the country in which God is currently residing. So wherever you see nationalism, talking, for example, about us Irish, we Irish. Now, funny enough, we white Irish include something, God preserve us if she exists, God preserve us from the 46.5 million people in the United States of America who consider themselves to be Irish. Who have so? Because there'll be room, they'll all be back. Let me tell you, post famine, we still have room on this island for at least 1 million more people to get back to our 1845 level of population. We still have enough land, and properly used, we can develop small, local, sustainable economies. Partly because we don't want to take over the world, we don't need a big defense budget. You know, like it's the same with bees and wasps. They'd only sting you when you start intruding on their territory, invading them, and beating them over the head with a flat end of an egg lifter or something. You leave people alone. You don't need big armies of defense. So there's a small island. Its total population is still short of its 1845 population. So we have room. We have room for immigrants. We have room for asylum seekers. We have room for refugees. We have room for our people, which are the working class of the world. We have room. We have resources. And we have an opportunity around this question of a border poll to open the whole debate again in the same way it was opened by Connolly, in the same way the left and Connolly took, we serve neither king nor Kaiser, into the question of the whole Home Rule movement. This is the opportunity for all of us to set out the vision, the mechanics, and the dynamics by which we can create the infrastructure for a new radical, socialist, feminist republic. And then when we know what the vision is, when we know what the shape of it will be, when we know what, how we get from street by street democracy, neighborhood democracy, municipal democracy, how we will work that out in terms of representation. Because there has to be a connect with that. You know, we have trade unions. So people join a trade union, people join the GAA. But then when you go to look at this national representation, it's only about where you live. What's that got to do with anything? What's your postcode got to do? Except that when you live in the poor area or the rich area. But if we had all the diverse interests represented from clear building blocks to the state, then we would have a democracy that was interlinked. Then we would have different resources. If when we're talking about how we build that kind of representation, we're mindful that some of the people who will be going will have children to look after. All the men who go have women who look after the children. But the women who go look after the children and go. So we would organize our sessions differently. And it's only that kind of vibrant, open discussion that gives us the basis on which we can challenge the fascist rising globally in every country in the world. This is a global movement of fascist ideology. And it's not in the dying throes of capitalism, because we have seen how capitalism is reorganizing itself. But it is the vanguard of capitalism, and always has been, in decimating the working class opposition to its own destruction, in confusing the issue of capitalism. So there's no point in having a debate. I'll tell you two things about the revolution. Globally, it will not be white. Get used to it. Globally, the revolution will not be white, because the world's population is not by majority white. We come from an imperialist. We live in the belly of capitalism, of the beast of capitalism and imperialism. And Ireland has a peculiar place in the middle of that. But it will not be won in 30 character tweets and opposition with the right. Get off it. There are uses for social media. Getting bogged down in shit with the far right is not one of them. So, the very simple messages, and I conclude on that, is people have to be aware that we have to take the argument of sovereignty from a class basis and not be afraid of it, because workerism is afraid of nationalism. The trade union movement, the left, has to recognize that in 2021, you're not the only game in town, and you're very weak. Much of this work is being done by civic society collectives. People like myself lurking in community development. Lurking, you say, what are you doing? I say, I'm lurking. In 25 years, I only retired last week. Lurking in community development, working on the ground. And I tell you why I worked there for 25 years. The real experts, because there's nobody an expert in anything. People only know what they know. And you can't fully know what you've never lived. You can abstractly study it, but you can't really know what you've never experienced. So academics and other people bring analysis to the table. The poor bring experience. Nobody knows how to survive poverty better than the poor. Nobody knows how to survive racism better than the travellers. Because that's where it is. And if you want to build the revolutionary movement, you want to build the trade union movement, you need to get out of the small conversations and bickering between people before profit and people after profit and people people with no prophet, and the Judean people's front, and talk to the working class, and they don't live. And the far right say this to you all the time. Is there anybody near you? Are you taking people home with you? Because they know, you know, that people coming into the country are pushed into the poorer areas. So if you want to win that argument, you have to be where the people are, and you're not. And I think that was raised during the weekend as well. You have to start speaking the language that the people speak. Most of the working class aren't on Twitter. They're listening to Joe Duffy and Stephen Nolan. And most of them don't understand data sets, PowerPoint. Our job is to analyze. But when we are organizing, we need to speak the language of the poor. We need to feel the experience of the poor. And we need to listen to the poor and not call them people with lived experience of poverty. Thank you.
We were going to take questions, but there's probably no need because I think we've heard enough and we can't really add to that. But long may you lurk. And and congratulations on your retirement as well after 25 years with STEP.
So that was Bernadette McAlisky speaking at On School Cosh Clee earlier on this year about nationalism and the far right. On School Cosh Clee, along with this podcast, The Week at Work, and many other podcasts, are all part of Left Bloc. And if you like the work we're doing, we really could do with your support and your help. You can throw a few quid at us if you have it to spare at patreon.com/leftbloc, or else go to the leftbloc.ie website. If you don't have money or the ability to contribute, we understand that as well. So please do what you can to share the podcast, share this content with your friends, your comrades, people you work with, whoever you think might be interested, and let's get the word out there. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you all very soon.